From our album of the week, that is Adrian Quesada. That one featured Giuseppe with, and the album is called Boleros Psicodelicos 2. You can read more about it at our website, kaxc.org. Let us know what you think. Text 218-326-1234.
You are listening to 91.7 KAXC Grand Rapids and 90.5 KBXC Bagley Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Listen at KAXC.org or on your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you.
Coming up this hour at about 8:15, we'll check in with Tornado Bob on the big weather picture. And at 8:40, a conversation with Mike Lynch of the Forest Stewards Guild. This series produced by Mark Jacobs. And we're going to learn about forestry for Minnesota birds, this project that's been going on, and what they've been finding out.
Sounds like an interesting conversation. I'm kind of excited to see what we can do, maybe what I can do with my forest to encourage more birds.
Yeah. Coming up at 9 o'clock, Headwaters with Malachi Coons. This afternoon, 1 o'clock, Michael Small, your volunteer host for On the River, a great mix of music. And tonight at 7, it's On the River with volunteer Heather Kidd. Right now, we're going to continue with Morning Edition from National Public Radio.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin in New York.
And I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C. Good morning. Ahead of the Independence Day holiday and the country's 249th birthday, three quarters of Americans say democracy is under serious threat.
That's according to a new poll from NPR, PBS News, and Marist. A similar number also see politically motivated violence as a major problem.
NPR political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro is here to talk about these results, as well as the general atmosphere around politics in this country right now. Good morning, Domenico.
Hey there.
So let's start with this question about the state of democracy. What did the poll ask, and what stood out to you about the answers?
The overwhelming majority, 76%, see the country under serious threat. That includes 89% of Democrats, 80% of independents, and 57% of Republicans. And this is coming at a time of great political volatility in the country. People are polarized and sharply divided, so in many ways they're living in different realities about what they perceive to be the threat, regardless of who's right or wrong here. Democrats see Trump and right-wing extremism as the threat. Republicans, though, were 31 points more likely to say that there was a serious threat to democracy when Democrat Joe Biden was president.
So, you know, we have to talk about political violence in this country. There were threats on President Trump's life earlier during the campaign season, two of them, in fact. And over the weekend, there was a funeral for the state lawmaker and her husband who were killed in Minnesota. So how are Americans seeing these attacks?
Yeah, here again, a significant majority, 73%, said they see politically motivated violence as a major problem. While there was little difference by political party, there was some division by race and age. Latinos, black voters, and younger voters, for example, were less likely to say politically motivated violence was a major problem as compared to white and older voters. And one other thing stood out here, on both questions, it was white women, regardless of education level, who were most likely to say that there was a serious threat to democracy and that politically motivated violence was a major problem.
That's interesting. So given all that, what does the poll tell us about faith in political leaders?
It's not great. I mean, people have very low confidence generally in the political leadership in the country right now, whether it's President Trump, congressional Republicans, or congressional Democrats. You know, first, when it comes to Trump, he gets just a 43% approval. And when digging down to key specific issue areas, he doesn't score very well on any of them. I mean, his handling of immigration is 43%. Foreign policy, just 41%. And his handling of the economy is worst of all at 39%.
And what about faith in the political parties?
Well, looking at Republicans in Congress, only 35% said they approve of the job they're doing. And guess what? That's the highest that Marist has recorded since it started asking the question back in 2011. Democrats, meanwhile, who are hoping to capitalize on Trump's relative unpopularity, plus the unpopularity of his mega bill that's making its way through Congress, are facing record lows. Just 27% approve of congressional Democrats. That's their lowest score in 7 years, back to 2018. And the reason for that is Democrats themselves. Only 44% of Democrats say that they approve of their party's approach in Congress right now. Compare that to 73% of Republicans who said so of their own party. If Democrats hope to take back the House next year, they got a lot of work to do to shore up their own House first.
That is NPR's Domenico Montanaro. Domenico, thank you.
You're welcome.
And if you want to dive deep into all of the numbers in the poll, they are on our website, npr.org.
A new study estimates that the U.S. Agency for International Development has helped save more than 90 million lives in the past two decades. This on the agency's last official day.
And yes, when the Trump administration took office in January, one of its first major moves was dismantling USAID. Today, nearly 6 months later, the agency officially shuts down. A few hundred remaining employees will merge their operations under the State Department.
NPR's Fatima Tanis has been covering this and joins us now. Good morning, Fatima.
Good morning, Leila.
Okay, so tell us what the last days at USAID have been like.
It's been very difficult for agency staff who've been saying goodbye to their colleagues last week. There have been lots of tears. People told me it's hitting them that this is the end. They said they were drawn to the agency's mission, to the idea of helping people in countries all over the world. You know, they brought up the USAID logo, which was on everything from clinics to food and medical packages, the words from the American people. And that was something staff said they really believed in.
So Fatima, without USAID, is U.S. foreign assistance just something of the past now?
You know, a quick reminder, the U.S. was the largest donor of global health and development funding. Much of that was done through USAID, which managed thousands of programs. More than 80% of them are now terminated. The administration has decided some will continue and the State Department will take on managing those starting today. The administration has made it clear it believes most of U.S. foreign aid has not been aligned with President Trump's America First policy, but it has not outlined a vision for the future.
And what's the impact been of shutting down USAID?
It's hard to overstate. You know, we're talking about cuts to thousands of programs in low-income countries that addressed health issues like malaria and HIV/AIDS, also humanitarian efforts such as feeding malnourished children. We also know that the shutting down of programs has caused deaths. For example, we reported on one child in Nigeria who died because the USAID-funded clinic he went to for urgent medical treatment was shut down. It was the only clinic nearby. And you mentioned earlier that study published in The Lancet, it projects that the cuts to USAID could result in 14 million preventable deaths by 2030. And while much of the impact has been felt globally, there's concern in academic circles and in Congress that there will be consequences felt here at home.
And what are those consequences?
So this actually came up at a hearing last week. Senators questioned Russell Vogt about the cuts to foreign assistance. He's the director of the Office of Management and Budget for the White House. Several Republicans brought up that foreign assistance served two purposes. It helped prevent diseases from reaching the United States, and also something called soft power, where you spend money to build positive relationships and create stability in the world. Here's Republican Senator Mitch McConnell talking about it.
Over my years in the Senate, the biggest supporters of soft power I've run into have been the military generals, who are fully aware of how much more costly it is to have a war than to prevent one.
McConnell went on to say that he also didn't like all of USAID's programs, but that the way the administration had gone after them had been, quote, unnecessarily chaotic and created opportunities for China to fill the gap the U.S. has left.
That's NPR's Fatima Tanis. Thank you, Fatima.
Thank you.
This afternoon on All Things Considered, as Israel bombed Iran for 12 days last month, internet outages left many in Iran with almost no information. The story of one woman, alone and scared, who turned to ChatGPT. Listen on your smart speaker, on the radio, or in the NPR app. We'll be right back. This is NPR News.
This is KAXE and the Tuesday Morning Show. I'm Jennifer Barr.
I'm John Latimer. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah.
Coming up in just a few minutes, we're going to talk with Tornado Bob Kanzemius. We'll get the scoop on this week's weather, what we can expect for July, perhaps.
Yeah. And maybe a bit of news about where he is, because he's not here. He is he's out chasing storms, probably in Colorado or somewhere near there. At any rate, we will hear from Bob in a few minutes, and we'll get the scoop on that. We'll hold his feet to the fire and see if he can't figure out a way to get the 4th of July to be a nice, warm, sunny day. Support for KAXE comes from Timberlake Restaurant, offering fresh-baked popovers, crafted cocktails, and a menu items such as walleye a la Ritz or chicken Kiev. Information about the dinner menu is available at TimberlakeLodgeHotel.com.
Support also comes from Grand Itasca Clinic and Hospital, home to an experienced OBGYN team that provides comprehensive women's health services, including maternity and advanced gynecology care, all in Grand Rapids. Learn more at GrandItasca.org. Coming up Saturday, September 6th, we are gearing up for Grand Rapids River Fest. Here on the banks of the Mississippi River with Courtney Barnett, Margot Price, Jeremy Albino, and Alan Sparhawk. You can find tickets and more information at GrandRapidsRiverFest.com. We are going to hear some music now from Jeremy Albino. He's one of the artists performing there. This is from his 2023 album called Tears You Hide, and the song is called Tumbleweed.
Down and out, follow me right through the dark, and we'll get out someday. See, but I know I'll make some memories, 'cause having you right by my side, I know we'll be alright.
That is music from Jeremy Albino. You can see him at Grand Rapids River Fest Saturday, September 6th, along with Courtney Barnett, Margot Price, and Alan Sparhawk. Find all the information and tickets at grandrapidsriverfest.com.
Support comes from Paul Bunyan Communications, offering technology for businesses like smart biz managed voice and Wi-Fi services, security cameras, and more. Online at paulbunyan.net, Paul Bunyan Communications, it's right here.
I'm Jennifer Barr with John Latimer. It's the Tuesday morning show. It is time to talk weather with Tornado Bob. Good morning, Bob.
Hey,
Bob.
So how is it going this morning?
Well, it's lovely here. The rabbits are outside the window just frolicking. The chipmunks have been out. Saw a gray catbird and a brown thrasher, so we've got that end of the color spectrum covered.
Great.
It's a lovely day, but we're a little bit concerned that that you and your compatriots have conspired to turn the 4th of July into a bit of a wet mess. Tell me it's not your fault.
Oh, it's always my fault to control the weather, right? Remember?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know what I did to upset you, but I'm sorry.
It'll be okay. The fourth is
Friday.
Friday.
Today's the first. It's Friday. Oh, yeah. Darn it. Yeah, that looks to be the wettest day this week. Yeah.
Oh, well.
Sorry.
No, it's quite all right.
Well, we've been telling people get your lake days in. Today looks to be lovely. I think Thursday will be a lovely day. Tomorrow, maybe chance of rain, but looks like our days leading up to it should be pretty nice. So enjoy it while you can.
Yes, indeed. Do that. And then even so, I mean, they say chances of rain on a particular day in the summertime, your odds of actually seeing rain at any given moment are really pretty small because it tends to come in short doses of like heavy rain in the summertime.
Yeah, I don't think it'll be an all-day affair on Friday as far as rain goes.
You know, yesterday was that sort of a day. I kept thinking, I should go sailing. And every time I would be like, I'm going to go sailing, I'd look out and it'd be raining. And then a half hour later, it would be sunny again. And I'd be like, I should go sailing. And then a half hour after that, it was raining again. I ended up with 0.08 of an inch of rain overnight, but all of it fell yesterday afternoon and just kind of, it was a conspiracy to keep me off the water, I think.
Yeah, yeah. I was there watching over you. And I don't want
you
to go sailing today.
Yeah, it could be a very good reason for that.
Showers. Yeah.
16-mile-an-hour winds have probably tipped the boat over.
Yeah, we're just getting into a typical summer pattern for this time of year. And on a large scale, the weather pattern kind of in the springtime with we get our stormy weather and severe weather in the early summer. We get a lot of these upper level troughs that move into the western U.S. And they bring up the moisture. Moisture comes in ahead of these troughs and then gives us the humidity and instability for severe weather. And then by the time, usually end of June, early July, those troughs are replaced by mostly ridges. We get either ridge in the western U.S. or a ridge across the central U.S. And there's a little bit, there's moisture still. The processes that are bringing moisture northward from the Gulf of Mexico are still in progress, but there's a lot less. Generally, a bit less wind shear, and the systems are less strong than they are earlier in the spring. So we don't see as much in the way of severe weather outbreaks and stuff. But in the northern part of the state, we still see some. I mean, in the northern part of Minnesota, if you looked at the climatology, it's a little bit more evenly distributed over the summer. And if you look farther south, like, say, in Oklahoma, it's definitely concentrated in May. As you go farther north, the concentration kind of goes a little bit more through June. And so at this time of year, we're out storm chasing. Like this morning, for example, I'm in Alliance, Nebraska. It's moving kind of a little bit farther north, and a lot of the severe weather episodes can happen anywhere from Montana over to Minnesota, sometimes as far south as Nebraska and Kansas. But this time of year, that's getting a bit farther north as the jet stream kind of retreats a little bit more to the north as the ridge builds over the U.S. So that's where we are, Alliance, Nebraska this morning. I wish our tour had started a couple of days earlier, because there was a spectacular tornado event in along the Minnesota-South Dakota border on Saturday.
I saw some videos of that. Yeah, that was quite dramatic.
Yeah. We would have had to spend a day driving up from Denver to get there. And then so if our tour had started on Friday morning, they would have driven on Friday. And then driven on, and then been in place to chase that event on Saturday. But and then if it happened later in the week, we'd have to be kind of giving up on that event and to get in place to get back to Denver on Saturday morning. So, but there's a problem. I figured there's like 3 out of a 7-day week. There's 3 out of those 7 days we wouldn't be able to see an event like that. 4, we would if they happened to be in the middle of the week for a typical 7-day tour. So anyway, there's a guy who posts on the Season Watch page quite a bit who was there, and I met him. I chase with him once in a while, and he was really right in the center of the action there. He had got some great videos and pictures. So look for that on the Season Watch page.
Yeah.
This tornado in southwest the east, it's Gary, South Dakota, and it was really interesting because it was a fairly long lived one. It must have been about 20 minutes, but it went through all these. The visibility was really incredibly good. A lot of times tornadoes are either wrapped in rain. Or if you're in farther southwest, like Texas or something, they can be wrapped in dust. But this one was clear visibility the whole time. It was a very well-formed vortex, and there was so much structure within it that you could see, and it went through these various patterns that just it was really amazing to watch the video from these.
Kind of a textbook example?
Yeah.
Nice.
If you looked at all the stuff that was ever, you'd see in a tornado. I don't know if it went clearly through a multiple vortex stage, but you can see any tornado, you can see multiple vortices within the tornado because of the processes involving spin, or what we call vorticity. It often breaks down, and the process can be a bit the vortex structure can sometimes be unstable, and it goes through these breakdowns. And but anyway, it was just pretty spectacular to watch the videos.
Of course,
I wasn't there, but just watching what was there was actually pretty incredible.
Did it damage much property? Was it in a town, or was it more in a area that it wasn't hitting much structure?
It was mostly over the country, but it did affect, actually destroyed one farmstead. There were a couple injuries there, but they're not serious ones. So it wasn't moderately impactful. Because a lot of tornadoes you see, they're just out in the open country, and they don't really even hit anything.
Yeah.
And
that's the kind that we like.
Right. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. That's what we come to see on the tours. And then if you're like looking, we saw a tornado. And then it's like, then it goes into a town or something. That's not good to see.
You are on, it's a tour that goes from like Sunday to Saturday. Is that what you said?
Yeah, started on Sunday, goes till Saturday morning. We have to be back in Denver on Saturday morning. We really don't chase on Saturday. It was just sort of a changeover day.
Yeah. So you start in Denver and then kind of go wherever you just track the weather and see where it might take you.
Yep. Yep. And the first day we went over to, Chadron, Nebraska area and saw a supercell storm there. It was a beautiful one. Started off the bat, we started the tour with a really interesting storm. And I mean, even without it, any tornadoes or anything like that, those supercells are just, I aim to see those things. And a tornado, I don't really, you know, we'll get them if we get them. You can't really say much detail about, you know, what type of tornado you're looking for. You're looking for supercell storms, and those are the ones that produce tornadoes. So you aim for those. You can see the ingredients coming together where, you know, where those are more likely. And so that's what you aim for. And if you get a tornado, you do. If you don't, you don't. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so we started the tour off pretty well. And then we had a down day yesterday. There's just nothing much in the way of storms within range for us. So we went and saw Chimney Rock and Scotts Bluff National Monument in western Nebraska.
Nice.
Now we're getting back in storm mode today. We're going to be going hopefully not too far away from here to see some storms. And then that beyond that, it's a little hard to tell exactly where it's going to be because the instability is building back up. But there's still a lot of what we call upper level ridging around. So not any strong mechanism for producing strong storms.
Bob, I've got a question. You talked about the ridge and the deflection of the jet stream. Talked about Oklahoma and Kansas having their severe weather more in May than in June. What happens to the weather in Oklahoma and Kansas once the ridge kind of pushes the jet stream a little further north? What do they end up with for a summer? What's their June, July, August like?
It's increasingly hot. So an average in June, it's the temperatures coming up into the 90s for highs, and then and that's kind of the way it is in July too. We can, you know, mid to upper 90s, and if you get a warm summer, it will often be, you know, have a lot of days with highs in the lower 100s. Yeah, just because you're underneath the upper level ridge, it's sunny every day. There's sinking motion in the atmosphere that tends to heat things up, and yeah, there's not a lot of active weather usually in the summertime. And if you do, you get some thunderstorms that move. If the cold front comes through, you'll get some thunderstorms, and then it'll dry out and warm up again.
Yeah. You talked about sinking. If it's really hot like that, warm air rises. I suppose the action of warm air rising pulls in cold air from somewhere or lower temperature air.
Yeah, well, what happens is there are other processes in the atmosphere, even if the air is warm, that cause things still to be pretty stable. So the warm air, if you have gradual sinking motion, you're compressing things and warming it. So if the warm air, if the air has an opportunity to rise, you form clouds and get rain. That's when the cold fronts come through. Along the front, you get rising motion along the front, but otherwise you're in upper level, under a high pressure system. Then those tend to have more sinking air. If the fronts down there, they come through, they get it down to Oklahoma or so, and they start to wash out. They dissipate because there's the processes in the atmosphere are more conducive to just building up more hot air, and cold fronts tend to weaken as they get farther south. So they get a little bit less rain as they go into July and August, and then when September comes in, it starts getting more opportunities for rainfall down that way.
Well, you've done a good job describing things, and you're going to be out chasing some storms today. But tell us just a little bit about local weather here. You say that if we do get rain on Friday, 4th of July, it's not likely to be lasting. It's going to be more showers. How does that all fit together?
Yeah, well, this time of year that we the atmosphere tends to be a bit more unstable. That we do get rain. I mean, it's not always like that, but it tends to with thunderstorms you get intense rain, and then you get periods of dry weather in between. So that basically that has the warm, unstable conditions cause the if you get a weather system coming through, then it breaks up that precipitation into more intense showers. And rather than in the wintertime, if you have a weather system coming through, the atmosphere overall is pretty stable, but there is also still lift going on. So you get steadier what we call stratiform precipitation. Everything's kind of evened out from, horizontally, smoothed out horizontally. And it's a steadier precipitation, but in the summertime, it's unstable. You get updrafts and downdrafts, and when you have updrafts, you have to have corresponding downdrafts. And in between those areas, when there's not an updraft going on, then you have clear skies. Just think of that in the atmosphere is when there's large scale lifting motion with our larger areas of low pressure that come through. In the wintertime, it's just gradual uplift everywhere. In the summertime, it's on average, it's gradual uplift everywhere, but it's broken up into, intense updrafts and also some downdrafts in there. So that's kind of what the structure looks like in the summertime.
All right.
So get a general chance of rain. You can get just showers, and you might get missed by those. You might have a sunny day all day and the rain hits elsewhere. How the summertime goes.
All right. Well, thank you, Bob. We will hope for the best. We appreciate your time, and good luck with the rest of your storm chasing tour.
Yeah, absolutely. Enjoy.
Thank you.
Yep. Yeah. Thanks, Bob.
Enjoy your week.
All right. Yep.
Bye-bye.
Bob Consemius. Yeah. Our weather guide, meteorologist and physicist and a chaser of storms and auroras, and just an all-around interesting guy, and comes in on Tuesday mornings to converse with us about the world we live in.
That's right. Coming up at 8:40, we're going to talk with Mike Lynch from the Forest Stewards Guild about forestry for Minnesota birds.
For KAXE News, I'm Danny Frere with the Up North Report. One person has died in a car crash Friday evening about 10 miles south of Aiken. 34-year-old Maggie Spichala suffered fatal injuries. She was driving an SUV with 39-year-old Patrick Spichala and five children ages 3 to 17 who all suffered non-life-threatening injuries. 18-year-olds Jimmy Dono and Cole Desmith were in a pickup truck and suffered non-life-threatening injuries. The family was headed north with a fish house on Highway 169. Dono and Desmith were traveling east on Tame Fish Lake Road when the vehicles collided. All involved are from Hazleton Township, where the crash took place. The Aiken Independent Age reports there is a GoFundMe set up to help the family with funeral and burial costs. Hundreds of nurses across northeastern Minnesota and the Braden Lakes area could strike next week. Megan Buffington has the story.
Over 400 Essentia Health advanced practice providers from nearly 70 facilities filed a 10-day strike notice Monday. They authorized an unfair labor practices strike last week. APPs include nurse practitioners and physician assistants. The bargaining unit voted to join the Minnesota Nurses Association last year. MNA says Essentia is violating federal labor law by refusing to begin negotiations for a first contract. Essentia is challenging the bargaining unit's certification, arguing hospital and clinic staff should be in separate units. Nearly half of all patient encounters and a majority of urgent care encounters are with APPs, according to Essentia. The provider says a strike could put patient care at risk. Erin Swanson is a nurse practitioner in Baxter and part of the APP's negotiating team. She says they're very mindful of the impact a strike could have. That's why they waited nearly a year to call for one.
No one wants to strike, right? Like, we all go into healthcare to take care of our patients. It's very stressful. My hope is that Essentia doesn't let it happen.
Essentia says it's exercising its legal right to review, and a strike will not speed up that process. Megan Buffington, KAXE News.
Governor Tim Walz declared a peacetime emergency on Friday following the severe storm that caused widespread damage in Beltrami County. Larissa Donovan in Bemidji has more.
The governor also directed state agencies to provide additional assistance to support recovery efforts. The emergency order allows for continued support to emergency responders in affected communities. The Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management will continue coordinating on-site support for local government, and relevant state agencies will provide additional necessary assistance. Around the hard-hit city of Bemidji, crews have been hauling away tree debris from the storm. City Public Works Director Sam Anderson says the trees are being processed on site with a great big wood chipper.
And then that contractor is actually hauling it away. So we're creating capacity as we go. And so as far as the overall volume, I think we have a plan in place for that. But that could be something that comes up on a bigger scale as other facilities are starting to fill up. And that's still the unknown of how much really is there going to have to be.
A storm cleanup will likely take months, if not years. Anderson says crews will be around multiple times to help residents with their cleanup.
We're doing, at least right now, the first round on our city streets. We do anticipate a second, maybe even a third. We're still trying to get a scope and scale. There's people that are having struggles even pushing what they have to the street because of how much volume they do have.
Volunteers with the American Red Cross were expected to begin damage assessments around the storm-impacted areas of the Western Leech Lake Reservation on Monday. American Red Cross and Salvation Army will provide resources at the former First National Bank building in downtown Bemidji through Wednesday. Larissa Donovan, KAXE News.
The last day to comment on the draft report about the Big Fork River watershed is July 2nd. The Minnesota Pollution Control Agency report identifies strategies to improve water quality conditions in Island Lake, Shallow Pond, Jesse Lake, and Little Spring. It also identifies potential issues such as excess nutrients in Round Lake, Dunbar Lake, and Bowstring Lake in the Leech Lake Reservation. You can find the link to submit a comment on our website, kaxe.org. That's it for the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Danny Frere, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is sponsored by Woodland Bank, dedicated to serving local businesses, families, and nonprofits in our area since 1920. You can find more information online at woodland.bank.
You can find more on local news stories and conversations at kaxe.org. We'll have the latest edition of the Up North Report today at 5:30 during All Things Considered. You can also subscribe to the Up North Report as a podcast. It is the Tuesday morning show here on KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr with John Latimer.
Good morning. We receive support from Edward Jones financial advisor Christina Gallas, helping individuals and business owners reach their financial goals. More information at edwardjones.com. Edward Jones, member SIPC.
Taking a look at current temperatures, we are at 68 in Park Rapids, 70 in Hibbing and Grand Rapids, 71 in Brainerd.
We receive support from Coldwell Banker Northwoods Realty, helping guide your real estate journey in northern Minnesota since 1947. From buying or selling to land or lakeshore, Coldwell Banker Northwoods Realty. More at coldwellbankernorthwoods.com.
KAXE's Tuesday morning show strives to take an in-depth look at some natural resource-based issues important to our region. We hope to discuss not only the problems, but also highlight some creative solutions. Today, we're continuing our series on the decline of forest birds. 4 years ago, Amanda Mahaffey from the Forest Stewards Guild informed us of the Forestry for Birds program being initiated across the U.S. And our guest today is Mike Lynch, Forest Stewards Guild from Lake State Region Director to talk about the recently completed Forestry for Minnesota Birds project. And Mark Jacobs, our producer for this series, joins us as well. Good morning.
Morning. Hello.
Yeah, thanks
for
joining us.
Hey, good morning. So, Mike, I'm really curious. You guys have been working on this for a little bit, and you've come up with a report. Mark held up a copy just a minute ago, and let me have a glance at the title, and I look forward to getting my hands on that book and learning more. But just in general, what can you tell us that you've learned? What should we be doing as woodland owners to encourage more birds?
Yeah, well, thanks for having us here today. Mark's been working on some of this stuff long even before we got going on this. And so some of the practice in Aiken County has certainly been a great demonstration to what this kind of turned into. So same product as you heard 4 years ago from Amanda Mahaffey that has kind of been brewing up throughout the different parts of the country. So we've got a renewed interest in folks managing forests with birds in mind. And so one of the great things we have here as an asset in Minnesota is a longstanding research group up at the Natural Resource Research Institute in Duluth, Minnesota, who's been collecting, I don't know, probably 30 years worth of data at this point on what kinds of things they see in the forest, whether it be created through management or just a natural occurrence, a tree blowing down or whatever it happens to be, on what is really helping bird populations. So one of the main goals with this project was to essentially consolidate that information that is in the kind of research sphere into a user-friendly, approachable document and set of recommendations for landowners, foresters, loggers, kind of the whole group that would be implementing some of these practices to try and help augment our bird populations.
And where did that take you? I mean, obviously lots of information to cover and lots of things to work through, but what's the one thing I can do on my 40 acres to help the birds?
Yeah. So yeah, great question to kind of synthesize down. We took 30 years of research and we turned it into I got the book in front of me. What do we got? 60 some pages. And then to reduce it even farther to answer your question, we have essentially a single table and we turned that into a one page handout that we can provide folks. And basically that breaks down to kind of 10 key things across habitats. Now, keep in mind, this product that we've done is for all the forested regions of Minnesota. So the forests down in Houston County and the Driftless are very different from the Cook County forests. And same thing over in Itasca County. There's variations. But across those, a few of the key things, having kind of structural diversity in the forest. So having, not necessarily that even stand of height, but having some gaps in there kind of creates these micro habitats for insects and birds to thrive on. Some large diameter trees and some young forests, both of those. So essentially a whole bunch of different aspects certainly play in. And water is always a key component for just about all life as well. But a lot of what we landed on through this process was that the standard forestry practices that are practiced by your consulting foresters, your county foresters, really just some small tweaks to that is really all this book landed on through some of that research stuff is really a lot of what we're doing on the landscape can really help breeding bird populations. And it's a matter of maybe changing a few things, a different species that you leave behind or a different formation of how you would leave behind a few trees, things like that. I don't know if Mark has some additional add-ons that he'd give to that response.
Yeah, it's kind of the concept of it's not what you take, but what you leave behind, that type of approach. But John, like your question, talking about what you can do as an individual landowner with 40 acres, one of the things that's really lacking is really that communication with all of the neighbors. You know, because when the bird is coming in there, they're not looking at your 40 acres necessarily.
They don't see my fence line.
So it's like, I don't remember, Mike, we were kind of looking at like 2,500 acre, like 4 square miles or basically the neighborhood that the birds would be looking at, you know, and if you can have diversity across that large patch, that neighborhood, by working together with other landowners, I think that would be a big, big important thing for birds.
Well, I, Mike, you don't know this, but Mark, you do. My 40 is some high ground, some low ground. The high ground was planted into pine plantations in the mid-60s. And so I have mature red pine. But over the years, as I've thinned the stand to keep, to keep growth happening, I've also sort of tried to recreate a more natural forest, because a stand of red pines, you know, 6x6 is not a natural forest. But where I have dieback, or I maybe find some trees with double tops or whatever, I'll sort of cut and clear an opening in that stretch, and then maybe somewhere else I'll let the pines be a little tighter. And my whole idea is to make it look less like a plantation and more like a natural forest, which seems to be the right way to go.
Yeah, that's very much in line with kind of what we're looking at here. One of the kind of really interesting take homes to me that I didn't really realize coming into this is that across habitats, and not just in forests, but also in grassland systems, the bird research has really indicated that birds really key into structure more than species. And I didn't quite realize that. I mean, there's certainly some species, you know, oaks and things like that, that have a lot more, food resources through the acorns and other insects feeding on them. But interestingly, the structure is really the key thing. So some of that work you're doing there to kind of create, some gaps, some ability for the birds and heat and things to kind of move up and down through that column are really important aspects there.
I find birches are coming in, balsams are coming in. I've got a lot of undergrowth, hazel. I wish there were fewer hazel and more of some other types, but I've got right now a pretty good crop of red elderberries, which is probably making the robins and the white-throated sparrows very happy. But it's just and I have a spot where I have some really old mature aspen. One has got an eagle's nest in it, and it amazes me that it hasn't blown over. It's been there since 1995, so it's had a few years of some strong winds, and I don't know why that tree stands, but it does. And the pileated woodpeckers like that area because of those big mature aspens. Right next door to that, I've got a stand of young aspen that are coming up. So try and keep it varied. Try to keep it, as I said, less like a plantation and more like a forest.
Mike,
that's great.
You are with the Forest Stewards Guild, and you are the Lake States Region Director. Can you tell us what the Forest Stewards Guild does and what your role is, what you do besides the forestry for birds?
Yeah, thanks for asking. So the Forest Stewards Guild, we're celebrating our 30th anniversary this year. So national nonprofit organization based in Santa Fe, New Mexico, practicing and promoting ecological forestry is kind of our baseline focus here. And so looking at ways that we can inform our forest practices by looking at natural processes that would have shaped forests over time, bringing an ecological approach into that. And so that manifests itself differently in different parts of the country. So I'm based here in Minnesota and work broadly on projects around forest stewardship in the Great Lakes region.
But that can look very different in different aspects. So, you know, one of the things we do is work with prescribed fire practitioners as a historic tool for tending our forests of Minnesota. And so that's another forest stewardship thing we're doing. And so that, and bringing in this forestry for birds. So it kind of runs the range, and it's kind of a neat opportunity in my role to be able to work some with birds, some with, you know, land management, some with the timber sales stuff, some with prescribed fire things. So kind of broadly across the spectrum of tools of forest stewardship. Also to be important to mention that we have a membership component to the Forest Stewards Guild. And so Mark here has been a member of the Guild. I'm not sure if it's for 30 years, but for many years. And so I don't know if he can give a little bit of information on what that has meant to him, I guess, over the years. But
well, it's been a good experience just because you kind of get to communicate with like-minded people across the entire nation. I was on the membership committee for a number of years, and we were working with people on both coasts and down in the mountainous regions. Got to compare notes. And, you know, it's just a good way to communicate and network, I think. One of the things I'd like to mention, things I learned through this whole process from the bird people is, you know, I always had this vision of, like, a golden-winged warbler, for example. You manage for young forest or brushy habitat for golden-winged warblers in the nesting habitat. But when they're young fledges, they actually go to mature forests. So, and I can't remember what other species that was. It the wood thrush, Mike, that they were talking about, where they nest in mature forests, but a lot of times they move into younger forests to feed and all that. So a lot of it has to do with having diversity across that landscape we were talking about. It's not just, like Mike said, it's the structure, not the trees.
I think it's quite interesting, and the point you brought up, Mike, about the idea, you know, that you want to sort of get together with your neighbors. And like my neighbor has hay fields, and he also has some wooded land, but he has hay fields. And that can bring in bobolinks, and every once in a while I'll see a meadowlark. But the idea, you know, let's just say I was in a neighborhood, in a city, or here in Grand Rapids, and I had a lot. The idea of sort of talking to everybody around you and sort of, you know, getting together on what the plan is going to be is kind of intriguing. I like the idea. I know one of the things that seems to happen a lot in the city is that when a tree dies, it's gone. They never leave a snag. I have snags all over because I've got 40 acres and I just don't have the time or energy to go after them, nor do I realize. I also realize that they are, you know, a good source of food and homes for a lot of birds. But that doesn't always happen in town, and sometimes you need to educate your neighbor who maybe has that dead tree and say, hey, it's in a spot where it's not going to hurt anything. Why don't you just leave that? It'll be good for all of us. Yeah. So that kind of communication.
Yeah, and that's a key thing. You know, obviously safety is paramount. So making sure that they're safe snags left in an area. Obviously, there's always some risk, of course, wherever it's left. But you know, we think of everyone's seen a birdhouse, right? Like, but what that birdhouse is creating is we're creating, in the absence of having a snag tree for a woodpecker to have carved out an opening, and then the chickadee to have moved in after the woodpecker carved it out and things like that. We're creating that in the absence of this, but really what the birds that live in birdhouses, every one of those birds that live in a birdhouse, what they actually want to live in is a cavity in a tree. We're doing a good job replicating that in some cases with where we can't have snag trees. But anyway.
So now that the Forestry for Birds project is out there, what are your next steps with it?
Yeah, so that's the phase we've entered. So last 2 weeks ago, I guess, Mark was over at, we had a meeting at the Cloquet Forestry Center to kind of look at what are some of the next steps here. And We had funding to develop this project. We're kind of trying to piece some things together to get the next phase out there. But what we're really trying to accomplish is getting a lot of these books in the hands of people who can essentially follow a little bit of that train the trainer model. And so we're trying to get as many of these opportunities to interact, you know, coming on this show here this morning or talking to other folks about knowing that this exists, and then trying to get it in as many hands as possible. Especially want to make sure we can get it in, you know, the hands of our foresters out there that are going to be interacting with a variety of different landowners and try and really amplify the impact there. So keep a lookout for different updates around. We'll be traveling around the state, kind of handing out books as we're able when we have printed copies available, and kind of essentially teaching folks about what's involved here.
We're speaking with
it's a very attractive book. I mean, the graphics are incredible. The people we had working on that, colorful pictures, all that kind of stuff. And I'm going to try to finagle a few copies away and maybe donate for the pledge drive coming up. So when people sign up to pledge, they can get a copy of this book and get it in the hands of some more people.
Wonderful. We're speaking with Mike Lynch, Forest Stewards Guild, Lake States Regional Director. Mike, how might, you know, if somebody's listening this morning and maybe they aren't, you know, interested enough, or maybe they don't feel like training trainers and they don't need the book, but you said you had a sort of a one page, 10 item list that could be available. How would people get in touch with you to get that?
Yeah, they can contact me, or they could, the easiest way probably to do would be to go on the Forest Stewards Guild website and then go to the Forestry for Birds tab that's on there. And there is, we've kind of been working on these projects in variety of states. So you got to go to the Minnesota section, but in there you can download a PDF copy of the book. You can download the trifold is maybe what we're calling the one pager. That one really does a good job breaking down, here are the 10 key things to think of, and the 10 key things to look at in the forest. And we've got a graphic on there that allows you to essentially assess your forest. And I think it'd be great on your 40 to grab that one pager, just kind of go out and look. We called it the handy guide. So it's like 10 fingers, and you can kind of count on your fingers. What of these 10 things do you have, and which maybe should you add to your forest management if you can?
Wonderful. Yeah, thank you. Mike, it's been a pleasure chatting with you this morning. Mark, as always, thank you for bringing this to our attention. You are a guide to a lot of things that would otherwise go unnoticed, and I appreciate the work that you do. Both of you, thank you for joining us this morning. Mike Lynch, the director of the Lake States region of the Forest Stewards Guild. And Mark Jacobs, retired land commissioner from Macon County and producer par excellence. Thanks both of you for joining us this morning. Been a great morning. Looking forward to more.
Once again, find more at ForestStewardGuild.org. Thanks, Mike, and thanks, Mark.
Programming is supported by Grand Dental Center, where doctors Lisa Johnson, Leanna McBride, and their staff provide full-service family dental care for patients of all ages in Grand Rapids and surrounding communities. More information at granddentalcenter.com.
Our weather today, sunny, highs near 83, slight chance for showers late this afternoon, west winds 5 to 20 miles per hour, partly cloudy overnight, lows 59 to 63, and tomorrow 30% chance of showers and thunderstorms, otherwise mostly sunny, highs in the low to mid 80s. And for Thursday, sunny, highs 83 to 87, southeast winds 5 to 10 gusting higher. If we look ahead to the 4th of July, it looks like we've kind of got chance for on and off showers throughout the day and highs in the mid 80s.
Yeah, check out our website for the 4th of July events taking place near you. There is a great long list there. You should be able to find someplace really nearby where you can take in the 4th of July. This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd.